Good morning. Yeah, John's been a great host. He picked me. He told me he was going to roast me this morning. Now I feel bad because I am going to roast him. He picked me up from the airport, and I'm like, this is a great guy. You know, he picks me up until we hit the park, pay for parking, and he searches around madly for money, and I have to pay. It's only a dollar, but it reminded me of a couple of my sponsees that never bring the seventh tradition, right? They're always, I just got a card again. So, no, John's been great. I've had a great time down here. Thankful for the convention for inviting me down. I am from the Portland area. I always say I'm from Oregon, not from Portland. So no judgment there. I'm a native Oregonian. So it is about 6:30 my time. So I'll be surprised as much as you are about what I share up here this morning. So let's get that out of the way. Thank you to the committee. Anybody that's involved with the committee here, please raise your hand because I want to give another round of applause. To the voice, that sets the tone for me for the meeting. You know, that can really have energy or it can really suck the energy out of the room. So you've done a great job this morning. Lee, I always want to thank Lee. You know, without the tapers, we have no history of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't have the Bill W. up here on the big screen. We don't have those talks. You know, the Dr. Bob, the Chuck C., and it's easy to go out and get a lot of talks, but Lee puts in a ton of work. All this work here, you know, he's like the traveling. He's on the road, right? He's like the Bob Dylan of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the never-ending tour. So, you know, support him as much as possible. I also want to thank these young ladies down here doing the sign for the hearing impaired. It was extremely moving to see Don down here get 2 days, and neither one of them knew that he was going to come up here and get 2 days in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that made my weekend right there. And welcome back, Don, and welcome to 3 days. Anybody out there with less than a year, you know, can you stand up real quick? And not to embarrass you, I didn't expect that many here on a Sunday morning. I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to congratulate you for making it through Saturday night and being here on Sunday. That is a huge deal. I want to thank everybody that brought these guys here this morning, because I know you didn't come on your own to the convention and sit around on a Sunday morning, right? You guys got better things to do out there. So I want to welcome you. I was reading through the pamphlet this morning on the things that I missed, and I'm like, because I was upstairs getting prepped, and I glanced down at the open discussion topic, and what I read was, who am I taking home from the convention? And I'm like, wow, these guys are really forward thinking down here in the South, you know? Like, there are no salt and pepper diets in Georgia, all right? So, but it was, what am I taking home from the convention? So, from there, I just want to introduce myself finally. My name's Aaron. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 24, 2007, and I owe that to God and Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group is the Can Be Saturday Breakfast Meeting, and we meet at Los Dos Agaves in Canby, Oregon, 9 a.m. on Saturdays. I was a little disappointed to find out they still have the meeting when I'm out of town. But if you ever come into Canby, Oregon, and I throw this out at every convention, every conference, meetings I go to out of town, I believe it's the best meeting that side of the Mississippi. And if you show up, I'll buy you breakfast. And we've had people from Kansas City, South Carolina show up for breakfast, and I get to host them and show them around Oregon, and I really enjoy that. So feel free to come on out, give me a call. I have a sponsor who knows he's my sponsor. That's important. I hold an active service position in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I like to be at service at the ground level. You know, I help set up my home group, tear it down, stuff like that. But my favorite thing in Alcoholics Anonymous is working with another fellow alcoholic that's brand new and watching the lights come on. You know, that's, to me, is the bare bones of Alcoholics Anonymous. Fifth tradition. Billy did a great talk on the traditions. I learned a lot in there. I like to say I'm still a student of Alcoholics Anonymous, and hopefully I am a student until the day I die. You know, it. I never want to think that I know all of this. I used to hear, you know, people that had 5 years and say, you know, I realized at 5 years, this is when I was know that I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, what? These guys are really slow learners, right? Like, what are you talking about? And the more years that go by, you know, I know exactly what they're talking about because there's always more to learn. Wow, John hid that like in a hole. Almost under the podium here. So, but what I want to touch on is the fifth tradition. You know, I believe we get to do this thing. The speakers get the most applause for the least amount of work. What I believe I'm doing here this morning, and that's why I like to acknowledge the people under a year, is I'm carrying the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. That's the only thing I'm doing here. And, it's an important job. And so I hope you hear something. Most importantly, I hope you feel something here this morning that keeps you coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. With all of that, I'll start out. I've talked a little long, so I'll start out. I was an embryo. I'm sure I ingested some alcohol as an embryo, but we won't go back. I grew up in a tiny little town called Eddyville, Oregon. If you don't know where that is or never heard of it, nobody in Oregon has either. Graduated with 19 kids in my class. It was we worked in the woods. My dad was a reforestation contractor. He was a functioning alcoholic. And by functioning alcoholic, he came from that same line. And my grandpa, who worked for Olympia Brewing Company, was head of sales, general manager for Olympia back when that was the big beer back in the 70s. My grandpa liked to say he never missed a day of work due to drinking either. But they used to tap the kegs. I talked to some of the drivers. They'd tap the kegs on the floor of the, you know, of the warehouse before they took off on their runs. So I'm like, it's hard to miss a day of work due to drinking when your job is to drink, right, and to sell alcohol. But my dad worked in the woods. I never remember a time where there wasn't some sort of alcohol in the house, usually Olympia beer. My dad will say, you know, for years he drank no less than a half case of beer a day. And that's just the way it was. My mom was the same way. I grew up, I knew no different. There was lots of, I'd say, extracurricular stuff that goes on. The conference, you know, says, you know, outside issues, I call them drugs, around the house. A lot of them are legal in Oregon now, but not back in the 70s and 80s. So I just grew up around it. It was never hidden. It was just in the open all the time. It was never like, hey, Aaron, you know, don't go to school and talk about this. So it was just the way I thought it was. I didn't start drinking on a regular basis till I was about 15 years old. And alcohol was accessible before then. But, you know, and I'm not going to say that I hadn't gone out and got drunk. But the regular basis, I started drinking alcoholically from day one. And the book talks about the problem drinker, you know, at a certain time, you know, if the consequences are great enough, your wife leaves or you get a DUI, stuff like that, you might be able to put the plug in the jug. But I drank straight through that. You know, from day one when I drank, I had no off switch and I enjoyed it. I love the effects produced by alcohol. I'm not going to be one of those guys that stands up here and said, oh, my life was rough, so I started drinking to hide my feelings or whatever. That's not me. It amplified my feelings. It amplified the chaos in my life, and I loved it. You know, so I started drinking on a regular basis, 15. By the age of 17, I graduated from high school. I'm going to tell you, I'm not that guy that ever got suspended from high school. I got along with my teachers. I got along with my classmates. But I love to drink. In a small town, I can honestly say everybody I knew drank. You know, 19 kids, we all drank, we all partied, we had the bonfires, the four-wheeling, you know, everything you do as a country kid. Graduated when I was 17 years old, and I went right into the workforce. My first summer, I fought wildfires. Right after that, I got into high lead logging. And high lead logging is dangerous work, and we're talking about the logging where you have 200-foot trees out in Oregon. And I know a lot of guys that have been killed just in my small town doing that. But it was a hard-drinking, hard-working culture that I went into. And it didn't matter how old you were. After work, we drank beer. We sat around the crew cab. We drank beer. They'd send rigging out to, you know, beer out to us on the rigging, and we drank beer. That's how I started to go into my alcoholism. But I still had a good time. 18 years old, I got my first DUI. That's where I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember to this day, you know, I'm 18, I got to get my court slip signed. I go into this town, the big town of Philomath I'd moved into. It had about 4,000 people at the time. Had police officers, started getting a lot of MIPs, stuff like that. And so I went into Alcoholics Anonymous, and there was my friend Marty says, you know, I walked into the room and the average age was dead, right? It was like there was a lot of older people in there, and this lady, she was probably old, she was probably about 45 at the time, the topic was Serenity. And I'm listening to this, I have no idea what they're talking about. And the Serenity, it gets to her, and she says, Serenity to me is I just stay home on a Friday night and I pet my cat. And I'm like, we are in two different areas of our lives, right? I'm like, I'm living 120 miles an hour. Now, as an adult, I look back and go, I wonder what she was really talking about, right? Like, maybe I should have stuck around Alcoholics Anonymous a little bit longer, right? So, anyway, so that's as far over the line as I'll get on a Sunday morning. I'm the spiritual speaker, right? I gotta reel it back in. So anyway, so that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized really quick that I could get my slip signed, right? It's an anonymous program. If you're new, I don't suggest that because I just don't. It took me down. So I started getting my slip signed by my buddies. They caught on real quick. I was doing an outpatient treatment program. It took me 13 months to complete an 18-week program. I was on Anabuse. Like, I haven't checked it out. I don't know if they still do it anymore. But basically, to get me to quit drinking, the court prescribes you poison. You go down to the pharmacy, and you take a shot of this stuff. And they tell you this can make you deathly ill if you drink on it. Well, I'm an alcoholic, right? I'm like, maybe, probably not me. So I start testing this stuff off, and it doesn't make me deathly ill. What it does, and I'm not joking, it turned me into a cross between like Hellboy and a boiled lobster. To the point, I mean, I'm bright red, like I'm driving, right? And I'd be going through town, and one of my friends would see me and go, "What was wrong with you yesterday?" When I'm like, just trying this controlled drinking on Anabuse. They go, I'm not driving by any cops. But that was it. Like, nothing slowed me down. It just didn't slow me down. And so by 19, I was married. By 20, I had a son and on my way to divorce. And I just, and my drinking just progressed. And nothing was going to stop me. You know, I was selfish, self-centered to the core. It only, you know, affected me. I turned my back on my family, and I'm not proud of that. I turned my back on my son and basically went out and did my own thing and let him be raised by his mom and his grandparents. And, you know, I was still working in the woods. You get real tired on the weekend. I got into some, you know, that other stuff, kept me up through the weekend. And, you know, I'll touch on that, you know, and I'm going to make it real apparent. You know, alcohol was my first demon. Alcohol was my last demon. In between there was a whole lot of stuff that was, you know, just sped up my alcoholism. Let's put it that way. So fast forward real quick, just where the drinking progressed. You know, by the age of, you know, I did a lot, started doing a lot of county jail time. You know, thankfully I had we did work release back then, so my boss would send somebody to pick me up at the county jail, take me to work, we'd get a lunch along the way, and then they'd drop me off at the county jail. So, and every night they would wash my clothes, logging, and fold them, and they gave me a little sack lunch, and I'm like, this is better than being married, you know what I mean? This isn't that bad, so. So, I mean, that was my thought process. Nothing slowed me down. I was still having a good time. It just, consequences were not in my vocabulary as a young man. They just weren't. So by the age of 24, I was in EOCI, the second largest prison in Oregon. I had a 19 to 24 month prison sentence hanging on to me right before then. I finished up with 56 days in treatment. A 6 month jail stint, and I got out of there, and I knew, you know, as a lot of us leave treatment, you know, I had a lot of self knowledge, 100%. I was gonna quit drinking, gonna quit doing everything. I'm telling people, hey, John, you know, I'm gonna be back for your graduation next week. You know, we're gonna stay in touch forever. And 2 days later, I'm out drinking and doing the exact same thing, seeing the girlfriend that I'm not supposed to see, and in right back into the same deal. And like I said, I had a prison sentence hanging over my head. I went out and did my own thing, stayed away from the cops for a little bit, and then about 3 months in, I got in a fight in the middle of a bar, and as soon as they called the cops and the cuffs were on me, I knew I was getting locked up. And so from there, I went into, it was a prison boot camp program, which it was about 16 hours a day, 7 days a week for 6 months, and I was one of 23 or 24 that made it out of 63. Because as an alcoholic, when you put some discipline on me, I can do all right. And so I did all right. I got out of there. People were opting to go back to prison for like 4 years, just wanting out of the program. And that was... But I was determined, you know. I was a small-town kid. I knew how to work hard, and I wanted out of prison. So from there, you know, I was still living in a pretty small... I was living in Corvallis at that time when I got locked up. So I was living in Corvallis, and I wanted to get away from the drugs and alcohol. So I asked my aunt if I could move up to Portland, you know. So you guys have heard about Portland. You know, not the smartest move, but she said she'd move me in for three months at that time. So I got up there. And I had to request permission from my PO at that time to move out of county. For all of those have been on parole or probation, I had to request that. And at that time, she was so sick of me. She's like, I will write this. You can move out of the county, but never request to come back. And that was how it was. I couldn't come back to my own county. So moved up to Portland, and I'll progress a little bit. The same thing. You know, I went out, and I had good intentions of staying clean and sober, and I go out, and in a couple months, I followed up with some treatment, go out. I go to a Christmas party. They have microbrews up in Portland. That was new to me, and maybe it's not going to have the same effect, right? So sure enough, alcohol, and I'm off and running. I'm trying to go to school at this time. I'm in criminal justice because I'm going to be a cop, and just straight out of prison. Big Book calls it delusional. And so I trudge along with that. 3.5 years later, I'm still living at my aunt's house because she loves me, and still working on that 2-year degree to get into the 4-year. And I don't have a job, and I'm flunking out of school. And she said, hey, Aaron, she goes, I think we've done all we can for you. And it wasn't like they were straight and narrow. My uncle played guitar all around. He's played all around the U.S. He was a local legend there in Portland. So they did their fair share of things, but I just wasn't going anywhere in my life. And so I moved out of there, started applying for jobs, started marking yes on the criminal history, and they told me in boot camp, you mark yes on the criminal history, and as soon as you get in for the interview, you just tell them the truth, what happened, and that's it. Hopefully you'll get in for the job. Well, my experience, I know this isn't everybody's, but as soon as I marked yes on that, I had a pretty good idea that my application was going in the trash can because I'm not getting any calls back. So I had a friend of mine that I used to rip and run with. He was kind of got his act straightened out, and he worked a good union job. And he said, come out here, put in your application, just mark no on it. They're fairly lenient on the background checks, and they'll get you in. And sure enough, I mark no, and I get in. I start working a pretty good union job. And I always say it was the easiest job for me that I'd ever done for the most amount of money. I'd cleaned up enough to get in, get past the UA once again. I think I'm going to straighten out my act. I work swing shift, 4 to 12:30. There's 3 bars across the street. You can kind of see how this plays out. Everybody wants to go out for work. You know, these are Teamsters. Want to go out in for a couple drinks after work. The difference between me, us, and most of those guys, 90% of those guys, is they can have a couple drinks, go home to their wives, go home, make some dinner, wake up, do whatever, you know, take their kids to school. And with me, it just ignites a fuse. And I don't know where I'm going to end up. It just gets the party started, and I don't know if I'm going to show up to work tomorrow. I don't know if I'm going to show up to work Wednesday, you know. And so that was the progression, and I started battling alcohol at that time. And I'm like, I would try to quit on my own, and I'd hit a few AA meetings, but I just couldn't stop, you know. And this was like 2001. I finally went to the general manager, and I said, this is the first time I asked for help. Part of it was because I felt like I needed help. Part of it, I wanted to save my job, and I showed him my attendance record was just atrocious. And I said, every time I miss work here, it's due to alcohol, and I need some help. So from there, they let me do an outpatient program, and I'm getting a lot more self-knowledge. I feel like I'm doing something for myself. I go in, I do well at work, start signing up for overtime, and a lot of us become really good employees, and you take away the alcohol, and I'm focusing on, I'm trying to change my life at this point. And so I go through a few months of outpatient, and during that time, there was a young lady that came to work, and I worked in a distribution center. And about 300 guys, and so there was about 5 women at that time, and they hired one, and so it was kind of like working in a prison. Like, if the women looked better than John here, they were beautiful, right? So it was like, it was kind of how it was. But, I mean, all jokes aside, there was a beautiful young lady by the name of Megan that came to work there, and we started striking up a conversation. I'm sober at the time. Her dad's name was Martin. He worked at Graveyard. I didn't know him. I didn't know his crew. And he had told everybody down at his end of the warehouse on his shift, my daughter's coming to work here, stay away from her. I didn't get the memo down on my end of the warehouse. And so right off the bat, you know, Martin didn't like me. And he started doing a little investigation on who I was, what I'd been, and really didn't like me. So I started dating Megan. Like I said, I'm sober at this time. And one of the first things I did when I saw this was going somewhere is I sat her down one night and I was honest. I said, you know, here's the deal. I have a serious drinking problem, and if I ever start drinking, you're just going to have to leave me, you know. And long story short, I went several months without drinking. During that time, her dad finally, after 6 months, he finally agreed to meet me. I went over to his house for dinner. He said that was the first thing that I did right. We sat through a very quiet dinner. And this was Martin, looked like a bulldog at this point. You know, he had the shaved head and the long goatee, and he did not look like a nice person, you know. And so it was very quiet, and Megan and I were going to go to a movie, and, you know, basically she said, Dad, if you want to talk to Aaron, you know, you're going to have to do it quick. So I was summoned into the next room, and this is how this talk started. He said, Aaron, he goes, these are the 3 things that I do not like about you. And it was all downhill from there. And it wrapped up, and it said, this is my little girl, and if you ever do anything to hurt her, he goes, I have no problem going to prison over any one of my kids. And he meant it. I knew he meant it. And so that was my introduction to my soon-to-be father-in-law down the line. And so, but yeah, I went on, long story short, I ended up drinking, and I went back to visit a buddy of mine in South Dakota. I'm going to have one beer. I contemplated it for a long time. I had about 9 months sober, and it sat on the table, and he said, you don't have to do this, you know, we can out, but I don't know how to have a good time without drinking. I grew up with, when I'd go visit my mom. And so, you know, the book talks about it. Once I get that obsession in my head, I'm going to drink. You know, and it doesn't matter if I sit with that beer in front of me for 2 hours, 2 days, whatever it is, I'm going to drink. So I contemplated about 20 minutes, and I wake up out of a blackout on his couch the next morning, no idea what happened. And that's the same thing that would happen to me tonight if I went out and drank. You know, I just don't get any reprieve from alcoholism. The only reprieve I get is in here, you know, contingent on what my spiritual, you know, what my spiritual condition is today. And so I go back and I told her the truth, and I remember her just breaking down crying. And I thought it was like she knew something that I didn't know. And so from there, what I realized was as an alcoholic as she wasn't going to leave, right? And it opened the door for me to do more drinking, and she wasn't going to leave. And she was the first woman in my life, and God bless the Al-Anon. She started going to Al-Anon to see what she could do, and she would buy me books on you know, controlled drinking and alternatives to abstinence. And I'd get to the point where it says, now you can try two controlled beers, and I'll be like highlighted. I'm pretty sure that's as far as I ever got in that book. And so I just can't, you know, I can't drink. I can't control it. You know, there's a story in the back of the book says, you know, when I drank to enjoy it, I couldn't control it. When I drank to control it, I couldn't enjoy it. And that was me 100%. And so it just went on for, and she stuck by me, you know, beautiful person, beautiful soul. And she stuck by me for the next, you know, we got married in 2006, you know, one thing I did, and I go through periods of sobriety. The book where I identify one of the most where it says one more attempt, one more failure, you know, and she'd see some hope. And I'd be, you know, I'd go so, you know, I'd get sober for a couple, 3 weeks, maybe a month, and then I'd fall short. And fall on my face. And when I fall hard. And she stuck with me, you know, and she was a beautiful person. She was the one that got me reestablished with my son. You know, he was 11 or 12 years old at the time. And I didn't have a totally distant, it wasn't like I never saw him. I said, I showed up, and I'm sure some of you could relate. I would show up at birthdays sometimes. I'd show up at Christmas sometimes, take a picture of me. There's a photo album. God, your dad was around, right? But I wasn't. Most of the time, I wouldn't show up. You know, I remember my dad inviting me down for Christmas one year, and my son was there, and he told him, your dad's going to show up, right? Your dad's going to come down here. And he said he watched my son, you know, look around the corners and in the bedroom and thinking I'm going to jump out, you know, and surprise him that his dad, and I just never show, you know. And that breaks my heart to this day, you know, it just what I did. But she got me reestablished, and I started having a relationship with him. Even though I was drinking, you know, like I said, I'd go through some periods of sobriety, and I'd get him up, and I had him for a summer or two. But I just couldn't stop once I started. And I realized it was detriment to my family, detriment to Megan. But what I did do a decent proposal to her while I was sober one time, and she accepted, you know, and I don't know why she did. Her parents really didn't know why she did. But we bought a place out in Moala. It's a little cowboy town. We had a house built out there, and she was basically just dragging me by my coattails. You know, I made decent money when I went to work, and she was dragging me along. Had a house built. We were married in September of 2006. And her dad, I remember him just giving me a lecture, like, you are going to stay upright through this wedding. That was as good as he could. You're going to stay upright. You're not going to end. And I did. And so, but the next several months, 2006 was probably my spiritual decline. Out of all the jail, the prison, all that stuff was while I was still having a good time drinking. You know, the 2006, I just couldn't. It was such a dark place. You know, there was times towards the end of it that I couldn't get out of bed, and I would beg Megan, you know, please just go down to the store, get me some alcohol so I can get up and maintain and balance myself out so I could go to work or not go to work, or so I could go down and get more booze, and put her through a lot. And so, once again, the end of 2006, I tried to quit drinking on my own. And there was times before that, you know, I'm sure you guys can relate to this. You know, I would leave work and say, you guys would invite me out for beer, and I'm like, I'm not drinking. You know, you give me a lie detector test at that moment, I'm going to pass. 30 seconds down the road, I'm pulling into the nearest Plaid Pantry to get myself some alcohol. And that's the craziness, that's the insanity of alcoholism. And so, the insanity of alcoholism. So, January 1st, 2007, I'd put together probably 20 days of sobriety. And I wrote a New Year's resolution. At the very top of it, I said, do not drink. Under that, I put, be a better husband, be a better son, be a better father. And you guys get the idea. Honestly, all I wanted to do is be a better man. And I was failing miserably, and I knew all of that fell under do not drink. January 5th, I go down Portland. I take my son down, and automatically, 5 days later, I want him to be a better father, and I go get some beer, and I'm off and running. I get a DUI with my 16-year-old son in the car. He takes me down. They put him in a separate police car. He's sobbing, and I go down to the police precinct where my brother-in-law Joe works. He's married to my wife's twin. Not the proudest day on the job for him, but he told another officer, he's like, yeah, that's my brother-in-law back there, and he needs serious help. He has a serious drinking problem. Incomprehensible demoralization. And there's many points in my story where I should have stopped, where I should have ended up in AA or in treatment, whatever. Her dad, Megan's dad, has to come down and pick me up from the police station and with her, and I'm mortified, right? So mortified, I'm never going to drink again until 2 weeks later, and I'm driving home. I don't know why they do this in Oregon. I don't know if they do it down here, but they give you your license back for 30 days after you get a DUI, and hoping you get another one. I don't know what the point is behind that. I'm driving home from work, and my car is like on autopilot, right? And you ask an alcoholic, it talks about it in the book, you ask an alcoholic 100 times why he takes that next drink. He's going to give you 100 different answers. Once in a while, it's the correct one. That's, I don't know any more than you guys know. And my car is on autopilot. I go in. I get a beer, one 24-ounce beer for the rest of the drive home, and it never stops at that. 20 years of drinking, it never stops at one beer, but it always starts there. And I'm still tricking myself after that many years that I'm going to stop at that one beer, right? And that takes me to whiskey, in and out of blackouts for the next 5 days. Her parent, they took away, Megan went to her parents. Her parents came over one day, tried to talk me into, you got to do something, go to work, and they're making me breakfast and putting, I was going to lose my job. They were afraid that I was going to lose the house. And, this is who their daughter married. And they stayed there for several hours. And I was going back to the bedroom. I had whiskey back there, and I'm taking pulls off the whiskey just to make sure I stay. And I promised them after I laid, there was a guy that worked with my father-in-law. And he had 21 years of sobriety at that time, and he kept telling me, you got to get a hold of Dennis. He goes to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's proud of it, and he worked in the warehouse. And, I'd bounced around in some AA meetings, and I'd see Dennis, I'd sit way in the back, and I'd see Dennis come in, and I'd bolt out the back door. I'm not going to make any commitments to this guy, right? And so I promise him, if you guys, I'm not going to go to work, but I promise I'll go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I promise with all my heart. I could not wait for them to leave quick enough. And I watched them walk out the door, and I'll never forget. And I remember her dad with his head hanging, down. And I like a father that just wanted to do the right thing by his daughter, right? And he couldn't. And I remember my mother-in-law turning back towards the house, and she had a look of disgust on her face. And I'll never forget that. This is who my daughter married. And Megan wasn't a drinker. She wasn't a drug user. She was just a good-hearted soul. And so, for whatever reason, at the end of that 5 days, Megan was at her parents, and I called her up and I said, "Please come home. Yeah, I need to talk to you." And she got there, and I said, "We need to talk about my drinking." And I'd lied about it. I'd said I was going to quit. 100 times I would apologize, I'm sorry. And she said, "Aaron, you know what I mean? When you say you're sorry, it means you're going to try to never do it again. And you always do it again." And she came home that night for whatever reason. I want to talk to her about my drinking, so I'm trying to give her part of the rest of my beer. She's not even a drinker. She's, "Let's talk about my drinking problem. Let's finish this off. This is going to be it." But, I just broke down that night, and I broke down, and it was from the heart. And I said, "I need help, and I've got a problem here, and I need help." And I wrote her a note that night. She went to sleep, and I wrote her a note, and basically said, "Megan, I love you, and I'm sorry for letting you down, and I'm sorry for letting your family down. And if you'll stay home today, I'll go to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with you." And she's a productive member of society, so she didn't stay home. But what I did is I went and I drove 10 miles to the nearest noon meeting because I work swing shift, and it was Free to Be Me in Oregon City, and it was in this old shack, the Buena Vista house, and I walked up those steps, and my life changed. I walked in there, and thank God somebody read out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it wasn't a check-in meeting. "How are you doing today?" or whatever the treatment center. They read out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what they read was, but what about the real alcoholic? You know, and I'll paraphrase here. Here's the guy that's been puzzling you. He builds his life down up and he burns it down. He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, more or less insanely drunk all of the time. You know, he'll have alcohol all over the house and, you know, hide it so people don't throw it down the sink. That was me. They were reading to me, the real alcoholic. And that caused me to buy 2 big books that day. And my first act of amends, I had to drive by my wife's parents' house, which was literally on the side of the highway, and I pulled in there and I bring my mother-in-law in a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I say, "Here, I'm sorry for everything that's been going on, and if you read this book, you know, you'll probably figure out why I've been doing it." I have no idea what's in the thing, right? Like, so that was my first act of amends, but what I do is I go home and I want to find that page. So I'm digging through the big book, and I'm reading it, and I find myself on every single page of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that meeting gave me hope. You know, it was just, my son will tell me to this day, you know, he said, "Dad, I can't believe how different you looked the first day that you came from Alcoholics Anonymous. There was, you guys gave me a hope, a spark, and I went back, you know, and I kept going back to that noon meeting. And the difference was I became accountable to that meeting. When their thing was, "Is there anybody here in their first 30 days of sobriety?" And I'd say, "My name's Aaron, I'm an alcoholic." Every day, "My name's Aaron," and I go, "They think I'm drinking every night, right?" Like, it's the longest 30 days, and I wanted to put that disclaimer, right? I didn't drink last night, but I mean, I'm still in my first 30 days. But that's what I did, and I became accountable, and people knew who I was. You get people start pulling for you and asking you if I have a sponsor. The first guy that came across the room and that introduced himself to me was Dennis from our warehouse. He didn't know me. He didn't know what I looked like. I said, "I know, Dennis. I've been dodging you for like the last 6 years." And he was the first one that gave me his number in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the first number that I picked up. You know, if you guys are new and get a phone list, pick up that phone, you know, and talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't know if this is for you or what it's about, pick up the phone and ask some questions. It doesn't have to be because you're struggling. You know, it's, "Do I want to come back? How did this work for you?" And 9 times out of 10, you're helping that guy on the other end of the phone more than it's helping you. You know, it goes both ways. So from there, I'm digging through the meeting schedule, and I find the Canby Saturday breakfast meeting. I'm starting to like this Alcoholics Anonymous, and these guys can afford breakfast. This was my thinking, so they're probably doing better than I am. And I walked into that meeting, and there was a guy, Steve, from the noon meeting. And he was the first one. I showed up early. It was the Canby Pub and Grill. I actually had to walk through the bar to get into the meeting. And Steve's deal was he always remembered the new guy's name. So I walked in there. There's 2 people sitting there. It's before the meeting starting. And he said, "Hey, Aaron, you know, how's it going?" And I'm like, I felt a part of, right? He remembered who I was. And when that meeting lit up, it was 40 or 50 people at that time, and it was like you hear the laughter in here and the excitement and the camaraderie, the unity, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I had no idea existed. And people talked about taking trips and climbing mountains and all this stuff, and I'm just like, there's a fellowship. I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was a program of whining and crying, and you guys came in here 12, you know, 1 hour a day and whine and cry and kind of, "Oh yeah, I got some sobriety. Well, good for you, but I felt like drinking last night." And then you came in the next day and nobody knew each other outside of the room. So it was an eye-opening experience to have this laughter and fellowship. And once again, it gave me a hope in a different direction, that there was life beyond this, that you could have fun in this thing. And I knew my hurdle was God. You know, I'm going to tell you now, I've been through the steps several times. So if you're new, this story is for you. You know, the old timers can listen in. You know, I want the new guy to know what led me to Alcoholics Anonymous, what has kept me here. And that's a power greater than myself. But that was my hurdle. You know, it was, I always say I took the first step. It took me 20 years to figure out the first step, and that was the first day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been working on that for 20 years. Second step is I came to believe in a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity, and I learned about that by reading through the book that first 30 days and going, okay, this doesn't mean I automatically believe in a power greater than myself. I came here to believe. You guys showed me something. I had a crack of willingness. And 3.5 weeks in, I hear a guy who's still a home group member today by the name of Ron. And Ron had been in a drunk driving crash in the late 80s, and he had killed a mother and her two children. And what Ron shared it was the feedback from the people that I heard that it was honest, and what he had done in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the forgiveness. He carried a letter of forgiveness from the victim's family, and it was so powerful that it just kicked the door, the idea of God open to me. You know, he talked about a guy, God bless anybody that does H&I, right? He talked about a guy that came in from the outside named Chicago John, and Chicago John had a manslaughter charge in Chicago. He was a boxer and killed a guy. And he grabbed Ron after the meeting in Oregon State Penitentiary, and he said, Ron, he goes, you can't unring the bell, but you never have to ring it again. And when Ron shared that morning, it just hit me in the heart. You know, so once again, I go home and I dig through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I find a simple prayer in there. And what I heard from you guys is the prayer works better when you hit your knees. I hit my knees, and this is to me, when I look back on it, and you might not agree with this, but I said, thy will, not mine, be done. And to me, that was the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous. Looking back on it, I just turned that my life to the care of God, and thy will, not mine, be done. As simple as that. And that's all I knew that I wanted to do. So I started doing that. The connection with God to me was almost, it was like a blank slate that just was filled. And I heard Ron tell that on a Saturday, and I had the breakfast meeting gives you the nice brass heavy metal 24-hour coins, so nothing against the plastic ones, but they gave me a plastic one in the noon meeting, but I have this brass 24-hour coin, and I remember sitting in, I'm in a warehouse distribution center, and it's huge. And I'm running forklift, and I hit one of the aisles, and this was my 29th day and rolling into my 30th day, and I could not wait for that 30 days, and I pulled that coin out, and what I know now is that was kind of a meditation, and I pulled it out, and I could not believe how different my life had become in 30 days, you know, and if you're new here, it can change like that. And I just felt that there was a presence around me that I had introduced, you know, a God, you guys had introduced me to a power greater than myself, and that my life was changing. And I clung to that coin and just thought about how good, although I knew I was going to lose my license, the whole nine yards, my marriage was going well. And I came home from work that night, and I found Megan, and she wasn't breathing. And I had to call 911, 24 years old, and I performed CPR on her. And they called her. They said, is there anybody here we can call? And I said, call her dad. And I gave him the phone number, and I continued to work on her. And the paramedics showed up, and it seemed like it took them an hour. And I live in a small town. It was probably only a couple minutes. And they went in the back bedroom, and they come out real soon. And they said, can we talk to you in the other room? And I knew right then she didn't make it. And her dad showed up, and what happened is Megan had epilepsy, and they always said it wasn't life-threatening. And she had a seizure in her sleep, passed away, just quit breathing, 24 years old. And her dad walked into the house, and I said, Martin, she didn't make it. And I remember him trying to rush back to the bedroom, and the paramedics grabbed him, and he hit his knees. And I heard the sound of a father's heartbreak that night. And it's something I never want to hear again, you know. And from there, we had to go tell my wife's twin sister. We had to tell her mother. And that was my 30th day of sobriety. I'm not going to tell you that I made it to the noon meeting the next day, because I didn't. But what happened Saturday morning is I'm sleeping in the living room because I couldn't go back. I couldn't go back to the bedroom. I couldn't do that for several months. And the front door opened. Door was locked. And every time I doubt a power greater than myself or a God in my life, I think of this moment. And about 8 o'clock in the morning, that door flies wide open. And it's Martin, Megan's dad. And he said, this is the last thing I promised my daughter, is to get you to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous this morning. And you're going to get up and you're going to go. She had called him the night before she passed away. I said, Dad, I got to work overtime on Saturday. And I knew nothing about this. Can you get Aaron to this meeting? And he said he would. And that's God. That's God. And he took me to that meeting. And that's where I got my 30-day coin. And a guy stood up, Steve Little, he stood up. He said, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. When one of us hurts, we all hurt. And it punched me in the heart. And we sobbed. And we cried. And you guys cried with us. And it was like Martin will tell you to this day, I've never felt the empathy and compassion that I felt in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that morning. And you guys welcomed him, and you guys stood after for a member, a family of a suffering alcoholic for an hour, and I got phone numbers and people. There was a man there named Phil who said he had a daughter that had passed away, and her name was Megan. And so you have those connections where you know God is looking back where you're exactly where God meant you to be. And they told us to keep coming back. And my buddy Gary, one of my closest friends to this day, I've traveled all over with him. I don't know him from Adam at that time, and he's doing secretary. He's got about a year of sobriety, and he gives me a hug, and he gives me a 30-day coin. He says, keep coming back. And my buddy Ron will tell you, if we were betting men, he said, on my year of sobriety, if we were betting men, we would have guessed you would have never came back. And I know what he means now, because I'm more surprised when people stick around in this deal than I am when they go back out. I had every reason in the world to go back out and drink myself to death. But you guys had given me hope. You wrapped me with love. You wrapped my family with love. We came back. And that man kept driving me there. And that man drove me to that meeting every Saturday for the next 3 years. And he's not an alcoholic. He apologized to me at 8 years in. He said, Aaron, I thought you were, I'm not going to say it from up here. But he said, I didn't like you. And he likes to tell people how much he hated me. And he goes, but I knew how important it was to Megan that you stay sober. And I saw it was working for you, so I kept bringing you back. 7 days in, when we had to plan a memorial, and for anybody that has gone through an unexpected death, it's very hard to do that. And my uncle sat up there a week later, and like I said, he played the guitar. For whatever reason, I had picked for us to dance to at our wedding, me and Megan, which was only 5 months previous. You know, we'd been married 5 months. And I picked Walk the Line by Johnny Cash. And but it was a slowed down, beautiful version by Travis Tritt. And I connect with music. It's where I connect with a lot of my spirituality, because it moves me, and it's like a never-ending love story. And the only thing I could get out of my chest that day is that this is the first and last song I ever danced with Megan, and it's Walk the Line. And it's a promise and a dedication to her. And you guys, you know the story, you know, and you guys have helped me walk the line every day for the last 16 years and keep that promise to Megan. And I can never repay you for that. I just can't. Martin drove me there every day for the next 3 years. I had court, all that stuff to take care of. I lost my license for 4 years. Breathalyzer, the whole nine yards. All of that stuff becomes so secondary when you deal with something like that. It was everything that I come in here thinking it was a big problem became so secondary. I couldn't share in that meeting for the first 2 to 3 years without sobbing. And Martin was the same way, and you welcomed him. And I'm so grateful for that. My mom, about 2 years in, she said, does Martin ever share at those meetings? And he does. And he would get called on because it was the language of the heart. When Martin shared, he was a simple man, and he'd say stuff like this. He'd said, you know, I might not have the nicest house. I might not drive the nicest car. But I'm one of the richest men I know because I got a family that loves me. And that's how I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom asked, does he ever share? And I said, yeah, he calls himself the honorary alcoholic. And when I said that, I just lost it. It was like God punched me in the heart. And what I'd realized for the last 3 years, 2 years, he had been saying he'd be honored to be one of us, you know. And that man is a father to me. I tell him, Martin, you haven't been like a father to me. You've been a father to me. 16 years later, I still fill an empty seat for him at Thanksgiving and Christmas. And that family has welcomed me, and he calls me his son. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the gifts of this program. You know, if you come in here and you think your life's broken and you think that your family's discarded you and you'll never get them back, I can tell you right now, you never know what God has in store for you. You just don't. I have a great relationship with my son. I have two grandkids, which is amazing to me. You know, it's like two grandkids, and I was there for the birth of both of them. My brother called me up, and Lee got a chance to meet him. He called me up August 1st, 2010, and he said, my sister-in-law, they've been together since they were 18, and my brother is one of those guys that would feed me full of booze and then call my dad and narc on me, right? Aaron's over here again. He's all screwed up. So I'm like, what's he going to do when I finally get cleaned up, you know? And I never pushed the program. I never said, you need to do this. I just lived my life. Attraction rather than promotion. My whole family knew what I'd been through. My whole family could see what Alcoholics Anonymous had done. So when he made that call August 1st, 2010, he said, Natalie's been drinking again. She's stealing all my medication. You know, it was okay when my brother would give that out if you were partying with him. But God forbid that you might go sample some yourself. And luckily, I found a meeting. It was the 12 and 12 Club. It was about 15 minutes from their house. And they went down there. He drugged Natalie to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they handed him how it works. And this is why I don't like messing with the readings at all. They handed him how it works. And he made it about halfway through it, and he broke down in tears like God had punched him in the heart. And they've both been sober since August 1st of 2010. That's a miracle. And what's funny is I brought my brother with me to a convention, and down in Florida I was telling that story, and about 10 Al-Anons attacked him on the way out the door. And he ends up with phone numbers and a meeting schedule, and which was awesome. You know, it was a cool deal. But we have a great relationship. He's involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't just get sober. His life has exploded in the right direction. You know, I couldn't ask for a better life. I've done some great things. You know, my deal is I connect with music. I connect with nature. And there were things. My life had become so small when I was drinking. My brother always says, I drank to be free, and when I drank, I created my own prison. And that prison, at those last days of drinking, was darker than any jail cell, any prison cell that I've ever sat in. It was lonely, it was dark, and I couldn't feel any light inside of me. A big trip to me was going an hour and a half out to the coast. You know, it really was. And Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I've got to go, you know, although they said I never could go to Canada, I've been there several times as an Al-Anon speaker. And not an Al-Anon speaker, that's a whole other story. Semi-rigorous honesty, my buddy Tim says. So I've been to Mexico. I always wanted to go to the Grand Canyon. I sit there and I overlook the Grand Canyon and at sunset and I see God. And you know, I've been to Wrigley Field with my uncle, and I'd never been to the Atlantic Ocean. While I'm there, I'm so grateful for everything that I get to do. I'm grateful every time I come to a place like this. You know, I was bragging yesterday. I walked from Georgia by myself, a little gratitude walk. I walked from Georgia to South Carolina yesterday, you know. I can't say that. I wasn't a guy that could say stuff like that. I love the life that has been given to me, and I'm grateful every day to God for giving that to me. You know, I've stood at the top of Mount Hood, 11,300 feet, and I trudged up there 18 months sober. And every step of the way, I thought about Megan, and I thought about you, and I thought about God. And I got to the top of that, and the wind's blowing, it was cold. I don't care how many layers you got up there. And I heard one time, it's like, I can't see the wind, but I know it's there. I can't see God, but I know he's there. And I'm on the top of that mountain, and I had a pocket full of Megan's ashes, and I tossed them to the wind, as close to heaven as I could get. And I thank Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thank God. I can't see him. The closest I can come to see him is when I look out, and I listen to you guys, and I'm a student of this deal, and I see God with skin on him. That's God. We're all connected. We're all one. I want to close. I know I'm going long. You guys are Sunday. And, you know, there's one thing that I heard in here that, and I'd hear it all the time. I heard it this weekend, you know, when Diana was talking about her parents. And my mom had MS for many years, and she ended up in a care facility for the last several years of her life, but it was right down the road from where I lived, and I could go over there every day. And my mom would, one of my biggest gifts, you know, you talked about the crying. My mom would say, when you were in prison, you were going through all of this stuff, I cried the blue out of my eyes. You know, I couldn't stop crying. And I would go over there for the last several years of my mom's life, and I would make her, she would just belly laugh, you know. That was the closest I could come. You know, I spent that time with her to her very last days, and she was in good mental health the last year. A couple years ago, right, while COVID was going on, and it was horrible. Like, I had to visit my mom. Luckily, she was on the first floor, but I would go up, and I would visit her through the screen window, and I'd make her laugh. And she started declining a couple years ago, and we could see it happening. And she was shutting down, you know. And they said once the MS attacks, she had had it since the 80s, but once it attacks, finally, it can go really quick. And so by this time, we finally put her on hospice, and I was able to be there every night for my mom. And I'd go in, and I'd talk to her, and we'd listen to Johnny Cash. We'd listen to Willie Nelson. And towards the end, she would only hear my voice. I'd go in there towards her last days. My mom had a smile that would light up this room. She wouldn't respond to everybody else. But when I'd walk in, I'd say, "Mom, it's me." She smiled to her very last day. And I would read to her so she could hear my words and just hear me. And we'd sit in silence, listen to music. And there was a book, and I won't break this guy's anonymity. I related when I read A New Pair of Glasses by Chuck C., where he said, "God is love, period." Right? And I've heard a lot of people say that. God is love. And that's where I connect. The love in this room, God with skin on it. And I'd bounced around in this book. Guy by the name of Willie N., I'll just say that. And I'm going to say this because, to me, this described God to a T. And I had bounced around in this book. It's called Letters to America, and I'd read a bunch of passages out of it. And there was one passage I kept skipping over, and everything was a couple, 3 pages long. And it said, God is a four-letter word. And I'm like, this is going to be some joke thing, right? And I sat down and I read it to my mom, and this is the last thing I read her. She passed away this night. And I know when I read this to her, my mom was at peace, that I had a God in my life and it was okay for her to go. And it's called God is a four-letter word. It says, no matter your religion, you likely have your own idea of what God is. Some think of God as that big guy in the sky who makes all the decisions for us. Some say God is a woman, and some say God is dead. Some say God never was. My view is simple. I believe that God is love, period. End of story. For love runs through everyone and everything. Every one of us loves the flowers, and the flowers love the rain. If you love the ocean, you know the ocean lives and loves to caress the shore. Love is the thing we all have in common. We ache for love. We hope for love. We love and like to be loved. And that's God. And as part of a song, it says, take these words of wisdom with you everywhere you go, to all the religions of the world, and through them the truth shall flow. But God is love, and love is God, and that's all you need to know. And then he goes on to write a letter to God, and it says, the universe in which we're born is infinitely large, and each of us is so small. We search for meaning when the meaning is all around us in every moment of our day. We search for you, God. We always have. We try to give you a form that we can understand. You've always been with me in all of your many forms. I started in a Methodist church, but found myself at ease with every religion I've tried to understand. I can't tell you now whether I'm a Baptist or a Buddhist. Considering my footwear, maybe I'm just a Buddhist, a boot-wearing man who believes we are put here for a reason, and that by doing our best, we may find the light we seek. If not, our souls are eternal, and perhaps next time around, we'll do better. You spoke to me in the church. You spoke to me in the fields and in the open pastures. You spoke to me in the songs of the mockingbirds, the blue jays who flew above us. Spoke to me through the wrestle of the Texas winds and the trees, and through the thunder in the night, and I paused to listen. you still speak to me. He spoke to me through the music and the guidance from my mother, who told me God always prevails because good and goodness can never be defeated. I wrote a song for you once called In God's Eyes, but maybe I wrote all of those songs for you, just as all of those songs were gifts from you. You were with me at the birth of my children and at the passing of my friends. You're with me when I gaze out on the blue bonnets of Texas. You're with me when the rooster crows at dawn. He doesn't sound sweeter than a mockingbird, but try telling the rooster that. I feel you when I marvel and wonder at the brilliant rainbows of Maui, and I sing at the little frontier chapel in Luck. When I stop for reflection on a quiet weekday in the Methodist church where my sister and I first lifted our voices to the heavens. The beauty of this world and the people in it have always been with us. You give us the power to see and smell and touch it. We are born of love, and it is love that carries us through. And those are the last words that my mother ever heard from me. I kiss her on the head. I tell her she was a good mother, and that I love her. And you guys gave me that gift, gifts that I can never repay. I want to thank you all for showing up on a Sunday morning, and let me tell you a little bit about my family and a little bit about God and how he's worked in my life. And I thank you all, and I thank you for being my teachers, and thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.